It's 6 Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific.
Why aren't they in jail right now? They brutally attacked a New York City police officer.
Coast to coast and around the world from the America Out Loud Talk Radio studios.
Our criminal justice system is upside down. It fails every day.
It's time for The Truth Be Told with Booker Scott.
Sometimes I really get tired of conspiracy theories becoming reality, but it happens all too frequently. As we get started in this hour, I want to connect some dots here and maybe put on that tinfoil hat. Last night on the program, Mel Witte and I were discussing about Speaker Mike Johnson and the amount of money that he has brought in, and we brushed upon a subject. We didn't go deep into it, but I think there is new developing news coming about what we brushed upon. What we brushed upon was a $3.5 billion for refugee resettlement that was in that $95 billion national security supplement. And what that may be used for, Mel mentioned it, that the Biden administration has already set up two different areas, two different offices for refugee resettlement in Europe. And I happened to mention at the time that the Pentagon is building a $321 million pier in Gaza that is supposed to be for aid, but could it be for more? That's what we're going to start this hour with. I'm Booker Scott, and this is The Truth Be Told on America Out Loud Talk Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. And this hour is brought to you by Gold Code. You can go to BookerLikesGold.com and find out if purchasing precious metals is the right thing for you. That's BookerLikesGold.com. So after we did that program last night, Mel and I started seeing this news coming out about what Joe Biden may have planned. And I even mentioned it in the program last night. The refugees from Palestine, which it doesn't even exist, they're from Gaza. They're Palestinians within Gaza. They're going to be coming to America. Just count on that. That's going to happen. I mentioned it a couple of times in the show last night. Here's what CBS News has found out from internal documents. I'm going to play this for you.
This news exclusively on CBS News. The Biden administration is considering a plan to allow some Palestinian refugees to come here to the United States. That's according to internal federal government documents that were obtained by CBS's Camilo Montoya Galvez. According to the plan, some Palestinians fleeing the war would be offered a permanent safe haven here in the U.S. And one option under consideration is to allow those who have immediate family members who are either American citizens or permanent residents to enter the country if they pass various background checks first. The plans would require coordination with Egypt, which has so far refused to allow large numbers of people from Gaza to cross the border into that country.
And that's where the port, the pier that the Pentagon is building right now for $321 million may come into play, because no one wants these Palestinians. No other country is allowing them in. The people do need aid, so they're building the pier for aid. But how quickly do you think that pier turns into a transport pier? That's where ships will go and pick up Palestinians to start the journey to America and their new home. It's going to happen, and so they'll probably pick them up at that pier, take them to Europe somewhere, where Joe Biden now has started these offices to resettle the refugees, and they'll get on a plane, and the next thing you know, they are going to be your neighbor. This is what is happening in Joe Biden's America. The Daily Mail has also been reporting on this, and they say top officials within the Biden administration are discussing this. And this plan may come into reality. And you have to ask yourself, why is this so important to the Biden administration? Well, it comes down to votes and this election coming up in November. Look at what is happening in these swing states. Look what is happening on college campuses. There are people that are not going to vote for Joe Biden. They are very upset at him. So this is a way for him to buy more votes. Look what happened in Michigan in the primary. Look how many people did not vote for Joe Biden. And this happened in other states as well. So Joe Biden somehow is trying to save those votes, and by bringing these refugees to America from the Gaza Strip, he thinks this is the way to do it. So now we're going to throw in, I don't know how many of these people will end up coming here, but throw them on top of another 10 million illegal immigrants that Joe Biden has come in, and we have a mess here, thanks to Joe Biden and the Biden administration. And really and truly, it's not him. He doesn't know what's going on. He's a vessel. We all know that. And there are other things that Joe Biden has done and his administration to try to sway the election. Representative Clay Higgins was in a hearing this week with a Biden administration official, and he talks about an executive order that Joe Biden signed in 2022 and the effect that it is having on elections. You may never have thought about it when it was done. You probably didn't know the executive order existed. But what the executive order does, it mandates that federal jobs over $35 million in states have to be done by labor unions. Are you paying attention? Labor unions. Who supports Joe Biden? Well, labor unions. Yet the people within the labor, the members of the unions, they don't support Joe Biden, but at the top, they do. The union presidents and the administration of the unions, they support Joe Biden becoming president again. Why is that? Well, let's tie that back to this executive order in 2022. Clay Higgins is doing this right here in this hearing.
I'm going to reference Biden Executive Order 14063 from February 2022. Use of project labor agreements for federal construction projects. That's what we're going to discuss. Earlier you stated you weren't familiar with the executive order by number, so I'm just clarifying. We're talking about the Biden administration's mandate for federal projects over $35 million to use labor unions. You familiar?
I am.
Okay, good. You believe in state sovereignty, good sir? I'm quite sure you're a proud American.
I am a proud American.
Thank you very much. We're happy to hear that. Do you believe in state sovereignty? Do you recognize the sovereignty of our states?
Yes.
Absolutely. So how would you, in your position as a high officer within the Biden administration, responsible for administering work and labor policies, how do you balance an executive order that mandates federal projects moving forward within the sovereign states use labor unions when 24 of our states, like Louisiana, is a right-to-work state, have specific laws or existing executive orders within that state, specifically forbidding a mandate for projects to use labor unions? How do you balance an executive order? You're a proud American. You believe in state sovereignty. You've stated that. How would you support an executive order that overrides state sovereignty?
And there is the interesting question from Representative Clay Higgins, who, by the way, is from Louisiana. And the Biden administration here has tried to sign this executive order, and they have. They have done it. So if there is a federal job in a state over $35 million, which is probably most of them, then the state then has to award that job to a labor union. Do you understand how that works? And then within these states, it is illegal either by law or executive order to have this happen. But the Biden administration really doesn't care. Like most things, they do whatever they want to, and then you have to take it to court, and eventually it will get overturned. But in the meantime, billions of dollars are already spent, and the unions have already made all of the money.
The specifics of the executive order directed the FAR Council.
I've read it.
So the FAR Council issued a rule encouraging PLAs. It is not a mandate. It is intended to promote competition.
It's most certainly a mandate. We're not going to get into the weeds about that. It's going to be argued in court, and we're going to win. But in the meantime, the Biden administration has effectively shut down large federal projects that had been long planned, permitted, authorized, and funded within 24 of our sovereign states. It's a massive transfer of wealth from red states, not just to blue states, but actually to labor unions within the blue states in an election year. We're going to sue. Many states are coming together. We're going to sue. We're going to win. You know we're going to win. The Biden administration knows we're going to win. But in the meantime, billions and billions of dollars will be transferred from red states, not just to blue states, but to labor unions and their entire organization machine within those blue states.
And what's going to happen? How long are we going to put up with this administration? Going over and around laws, making their own laws with executive orders, not through legislation that affects American families. We are being devastated. The middle class, the lower income, fixed income, through higher inflation. And now working families in these states that can't get these jobs. And the jobs are going to the unions. And who supports Joe Biden in the election? The unions. You see how all this works together?
You know, sir, you should know. You know that about 80% of the American workforce is not union affiliated? What do you have to say to those 8 out of 10 American workers that can't work in these jobs in these 24 states or elsewhere? What do you say to them?
Congressman, the rulemaking encourages competition. It does not mandate that a construction project cannot move forward.
Oh, you're a talking point, fella. Listen, I'm an American, you're an American. I'm an Army veteran. Are you a veteran?
I'm not, sir.
Well, you're one of the civilians that I serve and protect.
I appreciate your service.
So this is just two Americans talking. What do you tell one of the 80% of American workforce that no longer qualifies to work on billions of dollars worth of federal projects?
What do you tell that man?
I'm not asking you, Jamie. I'm asking Ms. Camilla.
I want every single American to have access to skills and a high-quality job.
That's your answer? You want every American to have a high-quality job?
Again, sir.
That's a talking point.
Congressman.
How do you respond to the family that cannot work? You know what's going to happen? The federal government going to push these states too far. If I was a governor, I would seize those projects and put them 100% under the sovereignty of my state. Would remove the federal government from the formula completely.
And really, this has been the pattern of the Biden administration since day one. Well, from day one, they started signing executive orders that has led to the destruction of the America that we love. That is what has happened. And some of those executive orders they signed on the first day, I've talked about it a lot, you know about it, were the reversal of Donald Trump's policies when it comes to the border. And Department of Homeland Security has finally released some data, and it's not good. It confirms everything that we thought and had been told, and I reported to you about flights in the middle of the night to certain cities. I'm going to get into some of that right now. In the past, I have done shows specifically on this, at least some segments on it, and this has to do with the CHNV parole program created by the Biden administration in January 2023, so over a year ago, that allows up to 30,000 migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to bypass the southern border entirely, and fly directly into the U.S. from foreign countries for a 2-year humanitarian parole grant if they have a sponsor in the U.S. And they say all are vetted, approved for travel. The flights are commercial and are not funded by taxpayers, they say. The program recipient or their sponsor pays for it, and the parole grant allows the recipient to apply to work. The Biden administration considers the program a lawful pathway, and the migrants flying into the U.S. via the program are not included in the southern border numbers. So the numbers I'm about to get into with you, They aren't in that 10 million number that is thrown around a lot that have just come across the southern border. Now, here's what has been reported in an internal DHS data, and it reveals that 45-plus U.S. cities have hundreds of thousands of migrants that have flown to them from this CHNV mass parole program. The data was obtained through a subpoena from the Republican House of Representatives, and it was provided to Fox News, which is where I am providing this information for you. The DHS data shows that during an 8-month stretch from January through August of 2023, so what is that, about 8 months, 8-month period, roughly 200,000 migrants flew into the United States because of this program. And 80% of them arriving in the state of Florida in only four cities. Those cities were Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, and Tampa. The top 15 cities, by the numbers, in an 8-month window, they go from Miami at number one with 91,821 of these people down to Austin, Texas at the very bottom, which only has 171. Other cities along the way, Atlanta, Georgia, about 2,000. Tampa, Florida, 3,500. Los Angeles, California, 3,500. So there you go with the Biden administration, again, dancing around the laws. In fact, Representative Mark Green of the state of Tennessee, he had this to say about it, quote, "What they're essentially saying is that the laws passed by Congress have said that these people are inadmissible, and so they created a program to try to get around those laws. The thing is, they don't have the authority to create such a program. By their own admission, they're breaking the law. And they do it over and over. Oh, by the way, unquote there. That's the end of Mark Green's quote. This is my quote. They continue to break the law all the time. It's what they do. And when they get caught, sometimes they may stop doing what they're doing. Most of the time, they haven't. They continue to break the law. So who's going to stop them? Nobody stopped them yet, have they? That's the way things go. I guess it was about 6 weeks ago I started the journey with Healright. You can find out about Healright at healright.com. That is the micronutrient bar that comes in four flavors. You can find it in the shop at americaoutloud.news. Make sure you use the promo code at healright.com, or if you happen to go inside the shop at americaoutloud.news, that discount can be applied at either one of those places. That's Healright, HEALRIGHT.com. Now, this bar, what it does, it helps your cholesterol, your blood sugar, can even help with your weight, maybe some weight management things. And it's 15 years of incredible research and study that has gone into this bar. They taste fantastic, and they seem to be working for me. They should work for you. Join my Heal Right journey and check out Heal Right, healright.com. And also go to the shop at americaoutloud.news. Make sure you use the promo code OUTLOUD.
More truth in minutes on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Trouble concentrating or recalling information is frustrating, embarrassing, and kills productivity. Nutrition company Healthy Cell created Focus and Recall to boost your brain power. And unlike other supplements that don't work, Focus and Recall is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients to help you immediately sharpen focus and strengthen recall. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited-time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back, guaranteed. HealthyCell.com, code Out Loud.
Well, Welcome back to the program here on America Out Loud Talk Radio. I am Booker Scott. Thank you for joining us here on this Thursday night. And I guess you woke up this morning to see what was happening on the campus of UCLA in California. I don't know what else can be said about what's happening on college campuses across the country. And I guess maybe we need to understand what they are trying to accomplish and then what they have actually accomplished. I think there are a couple of takeaways here that I'm going to get into. But one thing that strikes me about this are these people, they take control of an area of a campus and then they make demands. I don't understand why they feel they have any leverage whatsoever to make demands on the university that they have taken over. In the case of Columbia University, just this week, we saw the police went in. The New York City police did a fantastic job of going in there and clearing out the building there, clearing out the encampment. They're all gone. But before that, there was this from a student. The student was asked in this press conference, I forget what day it was, maybe Tuesday morning, that she was asked, why do you feel the need to have food brought into you? Because they had made demands to bring food to the people that had taken control of this building at Columbia University. And here was her response.
Well, first of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
But you mentioned that there was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for.
No, it's not. What you need to do is stop doing what you're doing and go to the lunchroom. No one has to bring you food. And this is one thing I don't understand about these kids, why they feel they have the leverage and the entitlement to have things brought to them. Because I'm going to get into what the people at UCLA, what they demanded before they were broken up. And it's bizarre to me, the things that they have demanded. Just to go through a list of what they say their needs are. And here's what they say. They say, please ensure the donations are BDS compliant. I'm not sure what that is. Urgent. Here's what they need urgently on the campus of UCLA for the people that have taken over part of the campus at UCLA. They need headlamps, airsoft goggles, gas masks, respirators, wood for barriers, knee and elbow pads, rain ponchos, canopies, utility gloves, super bright flashlights with strobes, charged. Bring them charged to us. Don't just bring us the flashlights with the strobes on them, but please charge them before you bring them and donate them to us. And they want umbrellas, which the umbrellas, I think that's hilarious. I don't know if you've seen those, but they are using these umbrellas as shields, and I've seen a couple of them after Columbia, and the only thing that was left were the steel part of the umbrella. And there was nothing like that. That's not a very good shield if you're going to go into a battle of something. In medical needs, they have those too at UCLA. They need EpiPens, of course, non-steroid inhalers. The kids didn't bring their inhalers with them. Headlamps, organizational bins, and for food, of course they need food. Please bring us food. They need hot food for lunch. Parentheses, capitals, important, very important that you bring us hot food, vegan food, gluten-free food, ice, no packaged food is bold and dark. So the entitlement of these kids is incredible to me. You know, the whole purpose of a protest is to bring attention to something. And what they were trying to bring attention to are the large endowments that these colleges have. UCLA, for example, has about a $31 billion endowment, and that money is invested in all types of things to grow that money. And part of what that money is invested in is things like a military-industrial complex that supports Israel and other businesses that do business with Israel and support them. These protesters want these endowments to quit doing business with Israel. That is what their purpose has been. So we'll have to see later if that has done any good for these kids and what their purpose was. But one area that I think they have accomplished something in is the propaganda war for Hamas against Israel. You can see it bellowing. You can see it growing that there are more and more people becoming vocal and supporting Hamas. And then on the other end of it, you have Joe Biden talking about bringing in refugees from the Gaza Strip. So politically, you know, it could be a win for these people that took over these campuses. But unfortunately, there are kids that are missing school. Some may miss even graduation after spending $150,000 to go to these schools. And speaking of money in schools, Joe Biden just this week announced he paid off another $67 billion in student loans. The Supreme Court had already said, you can't do that. It's illegal. But Joe Biden continues to pay off the student loans and try to buy votes as he loses, as the erosion of that younger voter continues to happen for him. And that is his answer. That was one of his promises in 2020, to pay off student loans. The Supreme Court said you can't do that, and he has continued to do it. And that brings up a bigger question also. What happens when one of the branches of government doesn't go along with laws? What do we do? Well, one of the things that we can do is impeachment and remove someone that does things like that. But as we saw with Mayorkas, that also doesn't work when Chuck Schumer and the Democrats are in charge of the Senate. So we have a tyrannical government. That's what we are left with. But another question that comes to my mind about colleges and these endowments and paying off student loans is the fact that the federal government actually pays these colleges and universities. Whether they're a private Ivy League school or a public university, the federal government is spending money every year on these colleges, and a lot of money. Look at Columbia University. $1.3 billion comes from your tax money every year to these universities. And now we're paying for the kids to go to school there. We're paying for both ends. Does anybody else see that? It's crazy to me. UCLA, about $600 million a year. All of these universities and colleges, our tax money is going to. I can remember when I started college, and it was a long time ago. It was 40 years ago. It's hard for me to believe that. My 40-year high school reunion is coming up. So about 40 years ago, I started at a university. And I remember how much it cost for a semester, books included, and food included. It was $1,800 a semester, $3,600. It was a public state university, and that's what it cost, $3,600 just 40 years ago. What has changed? Why is our tax money, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, going to all these universities, and then on the back end, the kids aren't paying for the school? The debt is being paid off, so we're paying both ends of this. It has become a racket in academia. That's the problem. We have another problem, too. We have Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie. They had a press conference on Wednesday, and I'm not a fan of what they are trying to do. And they're trying to vacate the chair of Mike Johnson. But Marjorie Taylor Greene in this press conference, which to me was a pretty sad press conference on Wednesday morning, there were the two of them standing there in front of a podium, and the podium had Uniparty with Mike Johnson on it. And it was, again, it was just the two of them standing there. And what they want to do is vacate the chair. But as this started, Marjorie Taylor Greene gave a speech, and I agree with what she said here, and I think you will too.
Republican voters in America, Americans all together, gave Republicans the House. They gave us the House in 2022. You want to know why? Because they were fed up with the Democrat agenda that is destroying this country. Wide open borders, an economy that's crashing, freedoms being stolen, COVID shutdowns, all the horrors that happened when Joe Biden took the White House and Democrats took full control. That's why we won the House in 2022. But what have we done with it? What are we giving Republican voters to vote for? Republican voters in America.
Well, what they have done with it is raised the debt ceiling, $3 trillion. They went through 16 votes to elect Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who they then vacated the chair, and then they put four people forth to win the Speaker of the House, and the first three failed to get to Speaker Mike Johnson, and now we're only 6 months away from an election. And one thing that she said that I would disagree with is this.
We have to have a Republican majority in January, and under Mike Johnson's leadership, we're not going to have one.
And here is why Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie are getting on my nerves. There's just two of them there. What is going to happen if they vacate the chair? I'm not happy with what Mike Johnson has done, but what is going to happen? Then what? I'd like to ask that question. Then what? What's going to happen? Who is going to be the speaker? You have a two-seat majority. What now will you accomplish? Between now and November, what does Marjorie Taylor Greene hope to accomplish with a new speaker? And who will that speaker be? And that speaker is going to be able to move an agenda in 5 or 6 months with a two-seat majority? And you have a Senate that's all Democrat? This is not strategic thinking on her part. I want you to understand that the message that the Democrats want is the Republicans cannot govern. They can't govern. Look what they did. It took 16 votes to get a speaker. They got rid of him. They got a new speaker, but it took four votes to do that. The Republicans are incapable of governing this country. Look at what they have done the last 2 years. So why give that to them? The Republican House of Representatives have accomplished nothing in the last 17 months. What does Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie expect to accomplish in the next five? It's nearsighted. It's not strategic. It's political. And here's why it's political. Neither one of these two representatives have any competition in their districts. They both won by 30+ percent. 30+ percent. But what are they doing to the guy that's sitting in the margin of error in a race? If you want the majority in January, you can't do this. Not right now, because it accomplishes nothing. It accomplishes nothing for those of us that want things accomplished. We need plus 30 or 40 or 50 seats. What she is suggesting here is political for her own good, because she knows her constituents love the way she talks. But there is no hope for anything changing in the next 5 months. You should understand that.
As a matter of fact, I was one of the Americans in 2016 that looked at a presidential stage of 17 Republican candidates, and the only one that stood out to me was Donald John Trump, the very man that stood out and represented Republican voters and Americans all over the country that were sick and tired of a Republican establishment failing us over and over again. That's why I supported him in 2016. That's why I supported him in 2020. And that's why I support him now. But what happened when President Trump became president and the Republican majority in the House and the Republican majority in the Senate is the Republican establishment under Paul Ryan failed President Trump and failed the agenda that we wanted to get done. They passed a $1.3 trillion omnibus that did not fund the wall after we had stood at Trump rally after Trump rally and said, build the wall. They failed us. They funded the uniparty agenda. They funded the status quo that Washington, D.C. just wants to keep going and keep going. And you know what happened? That's why Republicans lost the midterms in 2018 and Nancy Pelosi became speaker. Republicans didn't fight. They allowed the Russia hoax. And then what happened when Democrats took over the House? It was impeachment number one, and the entire war against President Trump continued. And that war on President Trump is the war on the same voters today that are ready to go and vote for that man in November and put him in the White House in January.
I believe the political move of Thomas Massie and their Marjorie Taylor Greene is a bad one. And I don't believe it's going to succeed. So, again, they are just looking foolish. And Marjorie Taylor Greene is starting to get on my last nerve. She really is. But speaking of Donald Trump, as she was, Donald Trump was on the campaign trail, as busy as he is in court. He was in Wisconsin on Wednesday, and here's what he said.
And every time the radical left, Democrats, Marxists, communists, and fascists indict me, I consider it a great badge of honor. Thank you very much. Because I'm being indicted for you. I'm being indicted for you. I greatly appreciate it. Never forget, our enemies want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. I'm never going to let it happen. They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you. And in the end, they're not after me. They're after you. I just happen to be standing in the way, and I always will.
And that is Donald Trump on the campaign trail. And he has his hands full in the courts and also in this race. The polls, a real clear politics poll that I just saw, it looks like Donald Trump is up about 1.5%. I don't know how much weight you put into polls. It seems like they are always wrong. When we look at Pennsylvania just last week, we saw that still Nikki Haley getting 18 to 20% of the Never Trumpers. She's not running, but she still got 18 to 20% of the vote, and I think that's a problem. And going back to what Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie are going to do by trying to vacate the chair, I don't think that helps. I don't believe that helps in unifying the party, the conservatives, and also gaining ground in the middle with the independents and the swayable moderate libertarians, conservative libertarians. I don't believe what they are trying to do is going to help at all. If you're scared about things in the economy, and I know you probably do consider it with everything that's going on between inflation and the GDP, possible stagflation, is that where we are? Maybe you should consider going to BookerLikesGold.com. When you go there, look for the phone number, call them. Make sure that you tell them that Booker told you to call them. Find out about purchasing precious metals in your IRA or your 401k. It may be the right thing for you, but unless you make that phone call and go to BookerLikesGold.com, you're not going to find out. So go to BookerLikesGold.com and find out more about buying gold and silver.
If you ask me, this whole world is gone to hell. I speak the truth, but these days they treat me wrong or right, I give my life for this place called USA.
More Truth Be Told with Booker Scott in a minute on America Out Loud.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutLoud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands? What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
The wellness company is offering the Signature Series Spike Support Formula. The wellness company supports this formula because it's designed to remove spike protein from the body. The Spike Support Formula is designed to help the body catabolize the spike protein, begin to remove it through its natural mechanisms. So go to twc.health and check out the Spike Support Formula. You can use our promotional codes or go through our banner bars on our site to get promotional codes and discounts on your purchase.
The Wellness Company shares your values and fights for medical freedom. They put patients before profits and follow medical science, not political science like doctors on the left. Their chief medical board, which includes Dr. Peter McCullough, are the makers of the incredible American-made high-quality spike formula. If you worry about spike proteins, go to twc.health and use promo code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount. Once again, that's twc.health, promo code OUTLOUD.
This is The Truth Be Told on America Out Loud Talk Radio. I am Booker Scott. Don't forget, coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, it is Unleashed, the Political News Hour. That's followed at 8 by the National Security Hour. And at 9 o'clock, it's After Dark with Robin Andrew. You know, as we look around this country, there are a lot of scary things going on. And if I said we're living in a negative world, what would come to your mind? Probably a lot of things, and probably none of them are what we're about to get into. I'm going to bring into the conversation now the guy who wrote the book, Living in the Negative World. His name is Aaron Wren. Aaron, welcome to the conversation.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I think one thing that you wrote in this book, we've entered a new and unprecedented era in America, and it's one you call the negative world. And if you would, just dumb it down for everybody. What is this negative world?
I'd be happy to do that. So the negative world specifically refers to the way that sort of society views Christianity. In my book, Life in the Negative World, I lay out a model looking at the last 60 to 70 years of American history, where we started out in the 1950s, where although we didn't have a state church, we did have a sort of softly institutionalized, generic, you know, Protestant Christianity is our de facto national religion. Mm-hmm. Half of all the people went to church. We were adding "In God We Trust" to our money. We were adding "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. We had prayer in schools. We had Bible reading in schools. Then in the 60s, I date it to 1964. You can quibble with the dates, but it roughly in that era, Christianity began to go into decline in America in terms of attendance, adherence, and people beginning to question Christian sort of moral norms and moral frameworks. And I divide this period of decline from 1964 to the present into three eras or worlds that I call the positive, neutral, and negative world. The positive world is 64 to 94. That is a period of decline for Christianity. I want to be clear about that. At the same time, society, especially at the elite kind of official level, still basically views Christianity positively. To be known as a good church-going man makes you seem like an upstanding member of society, and Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society. In 1994, we hit a tipping point and entered what I call the neutral world, which lasted from 1994 to 2014, where Christianity is no longer seen positively, but it's not really viewed negatively yet either. It's essentially one more lifestyle choice among many in a pluralistic public square. And Christian moral norms sort of had a residual effect of that era. And then in 2014, we had a second tipping point where, for the first time in really the 400-year history of, you know, settlement in America, official elite culture now views Christianity negatively. We're in this negative world, right? So to be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job at Goldman Sachs or Google. Quite the opposite. In fact, Christian moral norms are now expressly repudiated. And in fact, in some respects, certain segments of Christianity are now viewed as the leading threat to the new moral order. You see a lot of the hand-wringing about Christian nationalism being very much in this vein. And so this entry into a place where sort of Christianity, you know, certainly with the evangelical world that I am most familiar with, sort of viewed itself as the moral majority and now has to face the fact it's kind of on the outs. And this has been very dislocating.
Well, you go back to 1964. Are you able to put your finger on anything that happened that changed the narrative, to change that period from 1964 to 1994? What was it that happened in our country? Was there anything that you've been able to define?
Yeah, I don't subscribe to the "where did it all go wrong" theory. I don't try to necessarily go back. And you know, some people go back a long way. Some people say it was William of Ockham and nominalism's where it all went wrong. Charles Taylor, this Canadian philosopher, wrote a book called A Secular Age that told essentially a 500-year story of secularization. I mean, I would say, look, the trends were moving sort of away from Christianity in the West for a long time. I mean, even going back to the founding fathers, a lot of those guys were not necessarily in private, the most enthusiastic about Christianity. But the key is, the elite never really was interested in Christianity in many respects, but they felt the need to honor it publicly. And they said, well, we need to have this religion in the country to really have a coherent country. What happened precisely in the 60s? Well, a lot of things happened. Obviously, we had the upheavals, of the late 1960s, the sexual revolutions there. You had the generation gap with that, the Vietnam War. We saw the sort of collapse of the old, what they called WASP establishment, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant establishment that had sort of controlled the country in one form or another from a very long time. I mean, there's this guy who was president of Yale University during the Vietnam War, for example, was a guy named Kingman Brewster, and he was the 11th generation descendant of Elder William Brewster on the Mayflower. And so there were still, like, into the 1950s, maybe even the 1960s, members of the Adams family that played prominent roles. I think it was Charles Francis Adams IV that was the CEO of Raytheon, for example, for a very long time. And so, that all collapsed. And, there's just a lot of things that started happening in the culture in the 1960s. And then I think that the next major event that comes along that is really important is the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989. You know, the reason we're adding under God and stuff to the pledge and God we trust the money, it was part of the Cold War. It was part of our competition against this atheist communistic system. You know, Christianity was sort of bound up with the West war on communism. And once communism went away, we thought, okay, Western culture is going to be triumphant and carrying forward, and people might have assumed Christianity would be part of that, but what it actually gave was essentially a little bit of a green light to start rewriting the relationship between Christianity and culture and decentering and pushing out Christianity a little bit. I actually debated whether I should put the beginning of the neutral world in 1989 because of the Berlin Wall. You can make some debates about some of these things, but there's certainly been a lot of a lot of shifts in the culture over that time that really did transform society in that way. And again, it's not that the 1950s was some great high watermark of American morality.
Right.
Probably it wasn't.
No,
right.
No. Right. I after mean, World War like, II, the guys coming
right,
back.
There was there was a lot of hypocrisy. There was a lot of people didn't necessarily believe. But there was still this idea that, we had a sort of public religion in the United States, which was sort of a generic, generic Protestantism, generic Christianity. And like now the people who are running the country, kind of the elites have decided they don't need that anymore. We can dispense with that. And, to the extent that we have a sort of moral order, that moral order is based on ideologies. And the problem with these ideologies is they change all the time. Thou shalt not steal is kind of a timeless principle, if you will. There really was sort of a moral system that had prevailed for a long time. Of course, there's like emphases and changes here and there, but there is sort of an idea that like, okay, great, you can anchor back to the Ten Commandments or something. Well, now it's like whatever the flavor of the month is, right, Everybody's got to like all of a sudden tack in a new direction.
Right. And you see that in cities in this country now where they're not prosecuting and holding people accountable for going in and shoplifting. And now we see these shops moving out. So you can steal in America now.
Right. It's like you can walk into a CVS with, a couple huge trash bags, load them up and walk right out with impunity. But then again, there are people, for example, that said all lives matter on a company conference call and got fired.
Yeah, right.
So, you're more likely to get fired for an ideological transgression in some respects than you are for actually being immoral in some ways, as we would have normally understood it.
You're listening to Aaron Wren, and Aaron writes on Substack, aaronwren.com. Also, by the way, that last name is spelled R-E-N-N, so aaronwren.com. Aaron, you wrote something in your book, "The Negative World Poses a Profound Challenge to American Evangelicals and Their Churches." And it also helps to explain why there's been so much turmoil and conflict within the evangelical world. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, again, you know, evangelicals are used to thinking of themselves as the cultural mainstream, as the moral majority. And so having to make this shift from being a moral majority to a moral minority is quite dislocating. And because, you know, sort of Protestants, Christians were the majority for so long, they essentially, you know, relied on sort of the mainstream institutions of society to sort of reinforce their values. And those are the institutions they look to. Whereas, you know, minority groups, although they participate in and look to mainstream institutions, always had like their own unique institutions for their community to sustain community identity and life. And so the example I use is early 20th century Catholicism, where there was, you know, still a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment at that time. So they had to create their own Catholic schools. They had to create their own, you know, Catholic charitable groups. They had to create their own fraternal societies. They had to create their own Catholic universities. They had all these practices like abstaining from meat on Fridays or like praying rosaries that really helped identify and sustain their community life in a Protestant nation. And so evangelicals struggle in part because they never had these to nearly the same extent. So that's you know, part of the problem right there. It's a big psychological adjustment, and then the lack of these institutions. And then, you know, the vast bulk of evangelical churches and institutions and ministries were built for cultural realities that no longer exist. And so they need to change. It's just like how technology comes along and revolutionizes everything. First, there's the smartphone, right? So if you don't have that, if you can't adapt to the smartphone revolution, maybe you're an old landline telephone company, right? You're in trouble.
Yeah.
Right. Now AI, who knows what that's going to do? So, you know, if you have like a business or, you know, a church or anything built for an old reality, new realities, you know, force the need for change. And so I think that has really put a lot of pressure on the evangelical church and the various different groups that make it up. And I go through some of them in the book and talk about them a little bit, have sort of deformed, and they're now starting to essentially fight with each other, a little bit. And so I think it's just an uncertain time.
You write in the book specific strategies for churches, institutions, and individuals to live faithfully in a negative world. Can you share a couple of those?
Sure. You know, a quarter of the book is is diagnostics and the framework and laying it all out. And then the last three quarters are a little bit thinking about how we should live now. There's a lot in that. I'll just give a couple things. One, I think we need to move into more of an exploration mode and be more comfortable in the unknown, because we really are in an unprecedented scenario, an unprecedented time. And you know, the world is just rapidly changing, right? Who saw Donald Trump coming to be president? You know, who saw the pandemic? Who saw the invasion of Ukraine, Middle East upheavals? There's a lot of things going on in the world, and we have to be ready to adapt. And so we can't just easily plot, you know, our course from point A to point B. We have to be much more comfortable walking by faith than by sight, and thinking much more like maybe the Lewis and Clark expedition, where we're going into this kind of unknown territory and we got to feel our way along. The second thing I say is, again, churches need to be much more focused on self-consciously stewarding and strengthening their own communities, because the world is going to be a lot more negative than it was. And so self-consciously stewarding your own community strength is going to be very important. It's sort of like learning to think like a minority. And so doing the things that, again, minorities have always had to do. And again, that doesn't mean you have to be mean to people, hate people, all that stuff. But you have to think about, hey, how do we sustain our community life?
And what does
in
that
essentially
look like?
Something of a foreign land. Yeah. And
what does that look like, Aaron?
Well, I think some of it is, I talk a little bit about it in the book. I think a lot of it, I think the Christian education revolution is a good example of that. say, you know, we can't rely on the public schools. We have to create our own schools. We have to create homeschooling, create educational infrastructure to inculcate our own values. I think it involves finding a way to create a kind of moral community that can, you know, flourish and be distinct, like sort of a counterculture from the world. One of my things is, hey, we should not accommodate ourselves to the rising tide of long-term or even permanent singleness, which a lot of people in the churches are doing. We have to help our young people find a way to get married. And again, I'm not talking about people. There are people who don't want to get married, but there are a lot of frustrated singles who want to get married. Rather than trying to reconcile them to that condition, how can we help them get married and have successful marriages and have families? And so we have to just do the basics on some of that stuff.
You mentioned Christian nationalism earlier. Can you share some thoughts on that?
Well, I think Christian nationalism is sort of like the left's boogeyman. You know, it's
I've talked about it. I think it's something that they are positioning for the 24 election to make everyone afraid of.
Yes. It's, if you go back, you know, even to when George W. Bush was elected, right, people were talking about a theocracy. There's going to be a theocracy about that. You know, people like Kevin Phillips and Damon Linker wrote books. You know, basically, it's kind of ludicrous in retrospect. I mean, I think, you know, kind of evangelicals have never been further away from really the levers of power in society. And so the idea that we're in danger of some, Christian nationalist takeover doesn't seem very likely. And one of the things to keep in mind is, you know, the Republican Party still has a bright future, perhaps, in America. And Donald Trump may be elected, but increasingly the Republican Party itself, it represents a sort of post-Christian right in which, it's not necessarily animated by evangelical values.
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's more sort of cultural items and, you know, things of that nature.
Well, Aaron, thank you very much for joining us. The name of the book is Life in the Negative World: Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. And Aaron, tell everybody where they can find your work.
The book is available wherever fine books are sold, Amazon or where your local bookshop. And, definitely sign up for my website at aaronwren.com, and you'll be able to see all my work posted there.
And with everything going on in our country and around the world, it's easy to see that we are living in that negative Christian world, isn't it? My name is Booker Scott. Thank you so much for joining us. I really do appreciate it. Unleash the Political News Hour. It is coming up next, so stay right here. Don't forget, you were told 2,000 years ago that you are the salt of the earth, and salt without flavor, it has no value. So whatever you do, keep being salty. Have a great night.
There is only one truth. You've been listening to The Truth Be Told with Booker Scott on America Out Loud.